on such a special day. From a distance, it's been wonderful to watch and to hear of the blessing of God upon you, it seems, in numbers of ways over the last several years. And we see this as the blessing of God. It's wonderful. It's wonderful that the Lord has brought another pastor among you, and it's a privilege to be here. And I'm sure that I speak on behalf of Paul's parents, Jock and Patty, and on behalf of my wife, Susan, and myself. The Lord has taken one of the greatest joys of our lives and brought them here. So you are very special now to us in a way that is even more so than before. It's my assignment to speak to the church. Pastor Dunkerton has already spoken to Paul Hamilton, so it's my assignment to speak to you. And I'd like to direct your minds to three texts. There are three texts in the New Testament that are written specifically to give instruction to how congregations are to relate to pastors. Now, those same passages tell pastors how to relate to congregations, but that's not the subject, what the pastor should do. The subject now is how the churches should relate to their pastors. One is Ephesians chapter 4, and one is 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and the last will be in Hebrews chapter 13. But I'd like to establish something before we go further. I'd like to know whether you are people who read user's manuals or not. If you were to receive a new smartphone tomorrow, what kind of a person would you be? Would you look for the little pamphlet, the little user's manual? Would you download the user's manual? Would you read it? Or would you just go by intuition and you start pushing the buttons and you think, you know, if I don't know something, I'll learn it. If I make a mistake, it's no big deal. I don't want you to think that way about your pastors. There's a user's manual for pastors, how to get the most out of your pastor. And it's not something you should ignore, and it's not something you should allow yourself to think, well, I'll just be intuitive, you know, I'll just use him, whatever comes to mind, whatever my background might dictate. There is a user's manual. There are guidances in the Bible as to how congregations are to relate to their ministers. And so I want you to be people who read the user's manual, especially in this important matter. The first passage is Ephesians chapter 4. I'd like you to turn to these passages, please. The sermon will be rather brief, and so I hope that the passages at least will stay in your mind. The principle that I'd like us to see from this passage is the principle of complementarianism. We must embrace, if you're going to properly use your pastor, you must embrace the principle of complementarianism. I chose an odd word, hopefully because it's odd and long, that it'll stay in your minds. Complementarianism, you know what that is, right? That people, there are some Christian circles, and we would be in those Christian circles, who describe marriage as being an expression of complementarianism. And the idea is that the husband and wife in marriage have a reciprocal complementarian relationship. The husband and wife each have the same goal. The goal is to create a great marriage and then to create a great family. Has the same goal. But the husband and wife have different roles and different responsibilities and different gifts. The same resources, and the same motivation, even though they have different roles to play. Well, so it is in the church. You have to embrace this principle of complementarianism. You, as a congregation, the elders, you should have a sense of having the same goal, exactly the same goal. You have different responsibilities, you have different gifts, there are different things that you're supposed to do, but there must be this embrace. There must be this embrace with mutual energy, with mutual commitment to the same goal. Now, the passage that I want us to look at is Ephesians chapter 4. Maybe you know the context of Ephesians. Paul has begun by describing the grace of God to individuals, how all individuals are born into the world apart from God. All individuals are born, Paul uses the language of being dead in sins, being dead to God, not being alive to God. All of us were like that. All of the Ephesians were like that. He writes about how they have been, their lives have been interrupted by God, that God has loved them, and God has sent his Son for them, and God has given them faith, and God has united them to the Lord Jesus Christ and forgiven their sins. And he's united those individuals, those very diverse individuals, some were Jews and some were Gentiles, he's united them together in the church. And he makes several statements about the church, but then in chapter 4, he makes a statement of the goal of the church, and he's going to expand this in subsequent verses. Now, there's more to the goal of the church, but I want us to appreciate that he gives this goal, and he says this is the goal of both the saints and the pastors. Chapter 4, verse 1, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you are called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you are called, in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. Now look at, turn over a few more verses. The last part of verse 12, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love may grow up in all things unto him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Now, I'm reading that fast. You have an appreciation of the world of ideas that we've just read through. Well, it's not my interest to go back and explain them. My interest, though, is to see that this is the common goal. This is the goal of the church. This is the goal of everybody in the church. But in this passage, the Apostle Paul writes about differences, different roles that are to be played in this goal. Look back, please, at verse 7. After having given their common work, he says in verse 7, but to each one of us grace was given according to the measure of the gift of Christ. And then he goes on to identify something, one of the differences, one of the grace that's given. And he identifies men that have been given to the church. The resurrected Christ has ascended, given gifts. Verse 11, these are some of his gifts. He gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers. And these he gave for a specific function. And the specific function in this passage is for the equipping of the saints. Everybody has this common goal, but the Lord Jesus has given some persons who have this specific role. They are called to equip the saints. Now, these are the pastor teachers. And there's all kinds of things that could be said under how the men are to perform that function of equipping the saints. They're to teach, of course. They're to teach the Bible. They're to exemplify practical Christian virtue and godliness. They're to organize the church. They're to provide resources, all kinds of things that they should do to equip the saints. So you have this common goal. The elders have this specific function, but notice the congregation's function. The elders are to equip them so that they're to equip the saints for the work of ministry. It's the church that's to do the work of ministry. You don't hire these guys and say, great, now we've got these fellows to do the work of the ministry. That's not, they're supposed to equip, and the congregation is supposed to minister. Now again, it's not my intention to go into all the ways that ministers should equip us and all the ways that we should minister to one another. That's the subject for a lot more sermons. It's the point, though, that I want to make is that Paul is stressing the importance of a complementary kind of relationship. You'd never think of a congregation being successful in its goals by itself. You should never think of the ministers being successful in the church's goals by themselves. There's got to be this embrace that we are responsible to work together. Now today, we install Paul into the ministry of this church. It's a time to pray for him. It's a time to dedicate him to this special office. It should be a time of a really large introspection and devotion to Christ on his part. But also should be something like that for you. It should be something like that for you as a church. It's time for you to rethink. It's time for you to re-embrace. It's time for you to rededicate yourselves to the goals which the Christian church is supposed to have. Some of those goals are explained in this passage. It should be for you just what it should be for him. Now, it's special for him. This is the first time he's ever been ordained. You have had elders before, so this is not the first time for you. It's not special in the sense of being novel, but it's special in the sense of being important. This should be a time of No one should have the thought that now we've got a full-time pastor, we're going to pay him. Wow, he can do the work of the ministry. This is a time now to come together and say, this is wonderful by the grace of God. We have work to do together. We should not expect more dedication. We should not expect more passion from the ministers than we expect from ourselves. We should have the same goal. We as the congregation should have the same goal. We should have the same anxieties for Christ's honor, for the good of the saints, for the health of the church, for the spread of the gospel. The ministers may have more time. They have different roles to play. But we shouldn't expect them to be more passionate, more engaged, more energetic, more anxious for the things of God than we are. This is where the church and the people, the congregation and the ministers should be the same. They should be mutually committed to the same goal. If you were a football team, and if you could imagine each of you as players on a football team, and if the management had just hired the best coach in the league, you wouldn't sit back and say, this is great, this coach is going to take us to the playoffs. You wouldn't have any idea that having this great coach was going to be anything unless you threw yourselves into the coaching, unless you took the equipment. Well, that's the spirit that I think we should see from this passage. The second passage is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 5. If you turn to that passage, please. And the principle from this passage is that we must attain, we as a congregation must attain, an informed love of the pastor. It's not enough for us to embrace the principle of complementarianism. We must also attain. We must seek and attain an informed love of the men who minister to us. 2 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12 and 13. And we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. Be at peace among yourselves. Now, there are three positive admonitions here that Paul gives the congregation. One is to know these guys. One is to esteem them, and the third is to be at peace among yourselves. I apologize for these coughs. The first directive in verse 12, we urge you, brethren, this is the New King James translation, says, we urge you to recognize those who labor among you. Some of the translations say recognize, some translations say we urge you to respect them. Some translations say I urge you to appreciate them. It's interesting, none of those are really very good translations. They're all interpretations. The word simply means to know. We urge you, brethren, to know them. The word, the Greek verb here, is used 9 other times in 1 Thessalonians. Every time it refers simply to know something. We're recognizing Paul today. We're formally recognizing him. We're acknowledging that he is from Christ to be a minister in this church. That's not what this passage is about. You might assume that because we're supposed to esteem these men, you might read back the idea of respecting, but let's not do that. I mean, Paul is simply telling the people of Thessalonica they need to know the men who minister to them. It's a perfect infinitive. It has an imperative force. It's the idea that it's our duty to keep on knowing them. We are to know their strengths and their weaknesses. We're to know their peculiarities, the things that bring them joy, the things that make them sad. We're to learn about their family situations and their needs. We're to learn about their backgrounds. We're to understand the influences that have made them to be what they are. We should understand their age and their experience. We should learn how they think and how they teach. We should know them in all the breadths of the ways that might be considered. We should know these men. We're given this responsibility to minister to us. You might remember how Peter tells husbands in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, husbands, dwell with your wives according to knowledge. You're supposed to know your wife. If you're married to Jane, you don't treat her like you're married to Debbie because they're different. You're supposed to know them and dwell with them according to knowledge. Well, here's a similar idea. You're supposed to know your ministers. You're supposed to know your ministers and relate to them in a godly way on the basis of what you can know about them. The Apostle Paul, as an illustration, knew Timothy. And so when Paul writes to Timothy, he writes to him with an awareness of what he knew about Timothy. He knew that Timothy was young, and he knew that Timothy was sickly, and he knew that Timothy was easily discouraged. And so when Paul wrote to Timothy, he deals with him according to what he knows about him. And when he sent Timothy to Corinth, he wrote to the Corinthian church. It's recorded in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 10. He says, when Timothy gets there, don't let him be among you with fear, because he serves the Lord as I do. Well, Paul knew Timothy. So Paul related to Timothy on the basis of what he knew. He expected the Corinthian church to relate to Timothy on the basis of what Paul knew. We're supposed to know those men who have these positions in the church and relate to them according to godly knowledge. But the directive here is not only to know them. It is in verse 13 that we're to esteem them, we're to esteem them highly. Now, the word that's translated to esteem is referring to a mental calculation. It's not referring to anything subjective. It's referring to a mental calculation. We're to consider them, we're to regard them, we're to think of them as having first importance. And I repeat, this is not really a call to some kind of a feeling. Paul is not saying you need to develop these feelings. He's talking about a mental calculation. If you're asked, what do you think, emphasis on the word think, what do you think is the more basic language, Latin or Greek? Well, you're not being asked, what do you feel the most drawn toward? You're asking for a mental calculation. Which do you think is the most basic, Latin or Greek? Well, that's what Paul is doing here. Imagine that you're Juan Costello. Imagine that you're Juan Costello. You're the offensive line coach for the Ravens. You're lecturing your linemen about the importance of protecting the quarterback. And you might urge them to remember how important the quarterback is. You might remind them how important the quarterback is to their team's success. You might urge them to see the importance of the quarterback's job. You might say, esteem him highly for his work's sake. You might not like Joe Flacco at all. But if you're one of the linemen, you should see his importance, and you should esteem him highly for the work's sake. Well, that's what Paul is saying to these Thessalonians. They should know these men. They should see the importance of their work. And he says you should esteem them highly for their work's sake in love. And we are supposed to love them. It doesn't mean they're supposed to be our best friend. It doesn't mean that they're all going to be just the personality type that we're most drawn to. I mean, we're commanded to love our enemies, right? We're commanded to love our enemies, we're commanded to love our neighbors, and we're commanded to love our brethren, all of them. Well, ministers are to be singled out as being a special focus of the love of God's people. We're supposed to know them, we're supposed to calculate very highly the importance of their work, and that calculation is to be in the context of our loving them. I just repeat, that's not primarily a matter of emotion. There may become very sweet emotions between you and each one of your pastors. That'd be great. But love is not fundamentally emotions. You love your enemy. What does that mean? It means you pray for him. You do good for him. You have a pastor that might not be quite your personality type. He's certainly not your enemy. But he might not be quite your... You're supposed to know him. You're supposed to see the importance of his work. And you're supposed to develop love for him. Love in the Bible has all kinds of wonderful characteristics. It means that we should do him good and pray for him and communicate with him. Love involves giving the benefit of the doubt. Love involves covering a multitude of faults. Love involves suffering long and being kind. Love involves thinking the best and minimizing faults. Well, you can fill in the blanks. Love is a lot more than that. But the point is, this is a directive of the congregations. We're supposed to know these men. We're supposed to highly esteem them for their work's sake, and we're supposed to do that in the context of love. Now, why do you think that such a directive is necessary? Intuitively, you might think these men are so wonderful, but of course you just love them. They're just such wonderful fellows. Why would there even be this kind of an admonition? Perhaps it's because of their work. They admonish us. They rule the church. And some people find those two ideas very offensive. You mean somebody's supposed to admonish me? Somebody's supposed to rule over me? They're concerned about your marriage. They're concerned about your devotional life. Now, if they're good men, they won't be intrusive busybodies, but if they're good men and they see your marriage falling apart, they'll talk to you. If they sense that your devotional life, well, you might find yourself drawing away from these men because they're supposed to be, to some degree, intrusive. You read what Paul told Timothy to do. Timothy was to get in people's lives. Well, so here's this admonition. These guys are supposed to get in our lives. We should know them, we should highly esteem them, and we should love them. This admonition might be needed because these men are so imperfect. And that's true. All the elders you'll ever meet are very imperfect men. Some of the elders that you may have are in some ways inferior to you. They're not as old as you. They're not as accomplished in a secular profession as you. They haven't led as many men. They haven't lived in as many difficult situations as you. And there might be some situations where you think, this guy doesn't really know as much about life as I know. That may be true. That's okay. We're still supposed to know them. We're still supposed to esteem them highly for their work's sake. And we're still supposed to love them. The third passage is Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17. Please turn to Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17. Now, this passage obviously says a great deal about what pastors or elders are supposed to do, but remember, that's not our focus. It's how is the congregation to relate to the ministers? And I've simply given this the heading that we as the congregation, we're to have a sanctified self-interest. The way we relate to them to some extent is to be motivated by a sanctified self-interest. Hebrews 13, 17. Obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls as those who must give an account. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. There's a duty, obey and submit. It's too bad that the Greek word is translated obey. It's a passive imperative. It means to be persuaded. The people of God are supposed to open themselves to the persuasion of their leaders. Be persuaded is the first. That's the first directive, be persuaded. The second directive is to yield. Not to yield points of conscience, not to yield, but where there's matters of judgment, you can't have 15 opinions. So what do? You yield to these men. We're to open ourselves to their persuasion. We're to yield to them. But there's a rationale. Why should you do that? Because they watch for your souls as someone who must give an account. There's a duty. There's a reason for the duty. And then there are two motives. There's a secondary motive. I mean, there's an initial motive. And that is to do this so that they can be joyful in their work. Why should you do this? Why should you open yourself to persuasion? Why should you yield? Why should you care that they're giving themselves for the good of your souls and that they must have an account? You should do these things, he said, so that they would have joy. And why should you care about that? Why should you care whether they go through their ministries to you with joy or not? Because it's not profitable for you if you cause them grief. If you make it difficult for them, if you're not willing to open yourself to their persuasion, if in matters where it really doesn't matter, you ought to yield and you don't want to, if they know you as the person that makes them sigh, that's the word here means not to sigh. If they groan when they see you, if they sigh and they see you, if there's a reputation of you making it difficult for them to watch over your soul, that's not good for you. They'll be inhibited. There'll be a bad relationship. The context for effectiveness is gone. That's not good for you. It's right for us to have a sanctified self-interest. We need all the means of grace, don't we? We do. We need to read the Bible because it's a means of grace. We need to pray because it's a means of grace. We need the church's life, worship, singing, sacraments, fellowship, ministry of the ministers. We need, there are not many means of grace that the Lord has given to us. We need them all. So we should relate to the ministers in such a way that pursues sanctified self-interest. Now, the three principles which I'm trying to draw from these passages, is that we must embrace the principle of complementarianism. We must attain informed love, and we should relate to our ministers in ways that pursues sanctified self-interest. Now, before I've finished, I'd like to inject a rather sobering note. It may seem like these things are just kind of nice stuff and really don't have to pay very much attention to this nice stuff. I'd like you to appreciate that each of these texts are written to churches that are in hostile situations. It's true of the Ephesian church, it's true of the Thessalonian church, it's certainly true of these Hebrew believers. They were in situations where their houses were being plundered, their goods were being stolen, people were being put in jail, people were being persecuted. And you might think, why in those kind of settings would you be concerned about church order? It's because the church is ordained by Christ as one of the primary sources of stability to us as the people of God that the Lord has given to us. The Lord comes to individuals, he saves them, he brings them into the circle of grace, and they are very vulnerable individuals. And so he gathers them together into churches. And there's a sense in which these different individuals who are out there with all kinds of different backgrounds, the Lord saves them, brings them to himself, brings them into the churches. There's a sense in which we need to just embrace each other, take each other's hands, make sure we all get to heaven. The church is a vital part of the stability and the perseverance, even the salvation of God's people. And this relationship that the Lord wants to exist between the ministers and the congregations, that relationship has to be right, or this wonderful means that he's ordained is going to sputter and stumble and have very little good for our souls or for Christ's glory. The book of Ephesians is known as Paul's premier church epistle. And it's interesting how he ends the letter. He ends the letter by reminding them that they are in spiritual warfare. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 and following, I trust you know that passage. He says, "Be strong in the Lord, be strong in the Lord, in the power of his might, because you are standing against the shrewdness of the devil." He's reminding them that we do not struggle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, and against the spiritual powers of evil. Well, the American church is moving into a new phase of this spiritual warfare. We no longer live in a context where it's respectable to be a Christian. There's never been a time in our country, from the Bill of Rights until recently, there's never been a time where the government has been hostile to Christianity. Never have such large portions of our society been so openly opposed to God's law. You read it everywhere in Christian publications that freedom of religion has been eclipsed by demand for sexual freedom. Christians are no longer seen as primarily honest, virtuous, good people. Christians are now seen to some degree as haters and bigots and anti-intellectuals, people who should be marginalized if they can't be silenced. Sin is now enshrined in our laws, and the full force of the American government demands we conform to immoral statutes. The coming years are going to be more and more difficult for us as God's people, for you as a congregation of God's people. Those of you who are younger perhaps can't appreciate the contrast between what it was and what it is, how easy it was to be a Christian, and now how difficult it's going to be. And because of these difficulties that are coming to us and coming to you, the church must attain a strength far beyond what has been characteristic of us in the past. The American church, to some degree, has been soft and has been coddled and perhaps dulled to the ugliness of spiritual warfare that is around us. Some of you may know this story some years ago. It's supposed to be a true story. Amy Carmichael was trying to recruit workers for her mission in India. And she had experience with lots of volunteers, and she made the point she didn't want to consider anyone from America, because the American churches were not competent to produce people of the strength and spiritual vitality that was necessary for that kind of a ministry. She was probably right. You look around at the Christians in Christian churches, we're pretty soft, pretty coddled, very little self-denial, very little common engagement. That can't continue. The churches will falter. This should be a day of dedicating Paul to the Christian ministry, and should be a day for you as a congregation of the Lord's people to recognize that Christ has given the church for our stability, for our welfare, for his glory, for the spread of the gospel and the stabilization of his people. And you, as well as he, must dedicate yourself freshly to this great common enterprise that you have in this particular church, in this city, in this moment. May the Lord bless you.